Whether you're across town or across the globe. And if you like that little snippet opening the show, that's from a local L.A. artist, Laura Kane, and it was called Choose Love. And about tonight's show, first up, we have Amy Logan. She's written a delicious new women's thriller called The Seven Perfumes of Sacrifice, about the search for the divine feminine and the ancient lost origins of honor killing in the Middle East. And, you know, listeners, as you know, we usually don't have fiction authors on the show, but Amy has learned so much about this subject to write the book. She has a lot to share with us about women in the Arab culture. So don't go away. You don't want to miss this. Then, as we cross the threshold into the latter half of the show, William Kennedy will be talking about the book that might be on your bookshelf, but I bet you've never read it. You've probably never even opened it because it's so large, it's so thick and intimidating. It's The White Goddess by Robert Graves. He also had the privilege to have met Maria Gimbutas, so we're going to be talking about The White Goddess and Maria Gimbutas tonight with William Kennedy. But before we begin, just a bit of housekeeping. You know, we're doing commercials now to help pay for the airtime here at Blog Talk Radio. And I want to tell you about a good friend of mine who's going to be doing a talk at the Goddess Temple of Orange County on July 1st. She's going to be the guest priestess or minister, whichever title you prefer, during the service. And she's going to be giving a talk on the power of nine, rebirthing yourself in your business by offering the world your goddess-given gifts. She says, know what you're passionate about and tell your story. In fact, you should shout it from the rooftops. Create sustainable happiness and wealth for yourselves. Sometimes that seems self-indulgent and maybe even greedy, but the truth of the matter is you can't help anyone with your gifts if you're constantly worrying about money and how you're going to pay the bills. So definitely go hear Chris talk at the Goddess Temple of Orange County. She is a drummer, writer, marketing muse, creativity midwife, and she believes she can help empower all you goddesspreneurs out there. She feels like she has a renaissance soul, and all the twists and turns of your life's journey are sacred, and your unique story can help you bring your clients, your customers, and yourself magic to your life. Anyway, so think about that. Also, it is that time of year again. It is the 13th annual Isis Birthday Salon and Feast when we celebrate the annual birthday of Isis. And this year, guests will be delighted by wonderful entertainers and enjoy a sumptuous catered feast of Turkish cuisine prepared by a Turkish chef. The whole theme of the event has been inspired this year by the Visiting Aphrodite and the Gods of Love exhibit at the Getty Museum in Malibu, and we're going to be taking advantage of the comfort of our private space. So our afternoon activities will include ritual, dancers, storytellers, enactments, music, drumming, dance, will invoke both the essence of our beloved Isis, She of 10,000 Names, on her birthday, and her visiting goddess friend, Aphrodite, goddess of love, beauty, and life, the one who hails from Aphrodisias, Turkey. So I hope you'll join us for this annual celebration as we call upon these great mothers to journey with us in our annual celebratory ritual party. And just a little bit about what's going to be served for the feast. If you're not vegetarian, you're going to have a Turkish dish called karnayarik. It's split bellied eggplant stuffed with sautéed onions, ground beef, special herbs, baked in fresh tomato sauce with peppers. If you are vegetarian, you're going to have stuffed squash, stuffed with Turkish prepared rice and special spices. There's going to be hummus and palaki, those giant beans baked in olive oil and tomato sauce with lemon dressing, spicy tomato dip, something called saksuka, a deep fried eggplant, and squash and zucchini and bell peppers with yogurt, all sorts of delicious stuff, even this wonderful organic spinach and cheese filled filo dough, and of course birthday cake. So you'll want to make sure you don't miss this. It's only $23.50 per person, and this happens July 15th. It's going to be in Signal Hill, and I do need your deposit by July 5th if you would like to take part in that, and I hope you will. Also, we are going to be repeating the first five classes in that fabulous and oh-so-important Herstory course called Cakes for the Queen of Heaven in July in Venice Beach. It's $10 a class. And, you know, this is a bargain when you realize how many books it saves you from reading and the time. You could get a solid dose of Herstory and five interactive classes with like-minded folks where we talk about these important aspects of the sacred feminine. And this is something every serious goddess advocate really should take, really needs to know. For more on the curriculum, which was put together by the Unitarian Universalist Women, you can go to cakesforthequeenofheaven.com. So let's see. I think I am going to go ahead and skip to saying hello to my wonderful guest, Amy Logan, who is holding on the line here. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Karen. It is wonderful to be here.
Well, Amy, first I want to tell listeners about you, and then I want to read the back of your book, which I cannot wait to open because it seems, I use the word delicious to open the show. I really think it's going to be delicious. So we'll get to that, but let me brag on you a little bit first. Amy Logan's writing or photography has been published in the New York Times Magazine, the LA Times, the Dallas Morning News, the Denver Post, Vegetarian Times, Natural Solutions Magazine, and many others. She's worked on staff at several newspapers and magazines, published healthcare industry journals, and wrote nationally syndicated travel column with a million readers for Tribune Media Services College Press Service, a syndicate of the Chicago Tribune. She's contributed an essay in the 2008 anthology Mothering Heights, Manual for Motherhood, Volume 1, What We Wish We Knew Before We Became a Milk Machine, Short Order Cook, Shuttle Driver, Laundress, Mother, and that's from Mothering Heights Press, which became an Amazon number one bestseller in the motherhood category. She studied creative writing from a Booker Prize finalist. I think I'm reading that wrong. She has studied creative writing with Booker Prize finalist Ornest Lustig, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Henry Taylor, and National Book Award finalist André Debus. The third, and attended the 2006 and 2008 Squaw Valley Fiction Writers Workshops. The Seven Perfumes of Sacrifice is her first novel, but not her last. Thank goodness for us. Wow, you have been a busy lady, and you managed to fit motherhood in as well?
Absolutely.
Well, you know, whenever we say we wear a lot of hats, you know what? I don't think we give ourselves as women credit for all the things we manage to do and get accomplished in the world.
I give myself credit.
Well, good for you. Good for you. Well, you know, Amy, I want to start off by reading the back of your book here. Again, it's called The Seven Perfumes of Sacrifice. And I really, I think this is going to be such a fun book, and I know there's so much you're going to be able to tell us about women and what their life is like in the Arab world. But let's talk about the book first. So anyway, this is what the back of the book says. This controversial debut novel, over a decade in the making, is a woman's thriller about the search for the divine feminine and the ancient lost origins of honor killing in the Middle East. In this post 9/11 cautionary tale, an American writer struggles to civilize a tiny Arab village of Israel while trying to solve her friend's senseless death. Her intercession leads to tragedy beyond anyone's calculation. Will she have to sacrifice something even greater to get justice? What price are human rights worth fighting for? Her revelations could heal what seems hopeless. Logan discovered that just trying to discuss the issue of honor killing openly, let alone fight against it, was taboo in the cultures where it occurs. She realized that must be why this violent practice has continued unabated in some places for several thousand years. To try to understand and expose the mysterious underpinnings of honor killing, Logan landed rare homestays with the Druze in Israel and spent a decade researching and building a theory of the ancient lost origins of the practice. As she gradually uncovered a vast and true deception from the birth of honor killings, the seven perfumes of sacrifice began to tell her its story. Wow, that's provocative, Amy. So let's start with how did you become interested in women in the Arab world and honor killing? I mean, not that it isn't an interesting subject, but you know, it's you know, not really the first thing we think about, I don't think, as American women.
Yeah. Well, my very first time I really thought about the Arab world in any significant way, I think, was when I was 17, and I was a freshman in college, and I had the opportunity to interview the former Egyptian First Lady, Jihan Sadat, for the school newspaper.
Wow.
And, you know, they were calling her the most independent woman in the Arab world. And so, you know, that that experience really stayed with me.
Now, is she the Sadat whose husband was assassinated?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And did you find that she really was liberated, or, I mean, was the interview really not that, you know, I mean, could you dig that deep?
Well, you know, it's interesting because one thing that you find out when you you know, begin to learn about the Middle East is that there's not a single stereotype of, you know, women are this way throughout the Middle East. It depends on the country, the community, the village, the particular culture, the time in history, and also the amount of education and the economic status of her family.
Okay,
you know,
what
class she's in other words.
So,
and women of power like Sadat, you know, there weren't a lot of doors closed to her.
So the more power and money you have as a woman, probably the more freedom you have.
In some cases.
Okay.
In certain countries, I think that is not necessarily true. Saudi Arabia is an example where it does not mean that you're going to be free if you are, you know, a princess even.
Right. Well, and maybe if you're a princess, you know, you're almost, you know, sort of a bird in a gilded cage that, and so you can't be free because you would, you know, you would be setting a tone for all the women that they want to keep oppressed. So I can understand how that would be a trap.
Exactly. And I've just finished reading Princess, a memoir written by Jean Sesson. It's a first in a trilogy memoir of a princess who told her story to this American woman who published these books, and I really recommend those as well.
Okay, so those are true stories.
Yeah, true story about what it's like to be a princess in Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
And after all I have studied and learned over the last decade, even I was shocked and disturbed by what I read.
Okay, well, we're going to get into all of that because this is just this is really provocative stuff. And, you know, at this time in our lives, I think the more we know, the better. But let me ask you, I'm wondering when, now you traveled, you traveled extensively to do this book. You researched this topic for more than a decade. Just briefly, what was the timeline of your life? You went to college. I mean, did you, you know, get married and become a mother before or after you did all of this research and travel? Or how did it all fit together? What was your timeline?
Yeah. Well, I initially, it was in my late 20s that I was actually, before I became a mother, that I was brought over to Israel by the Israeli Ministry of Tourism when I was writing that travel column. I was brought over with a group of travel journalists to write about the country. And while I was there, we were introduced to a minority called the Druze, and we spent an afternoon with them. They are Arabic in language and culture, but they have their own secretive religion called Tawhid that came out of Islam about 1,000 years ago. They believe in reincarnation, and that is enough to make them heretics to many Muslims. So the Druze keep a lot of their faith secret to avoid persecution.
Okay, wait. Why? I have to ask you this. Why? Because, you know, a lot of us don't know a lot about Islam. Why would that make them heretics?
Because it is not Islamic to believe in reincarnation.
What do Muslims believe happens to you when you die?
I am not qualified to speak on that because I really studied the Druze infinitely more, since that is the culture that I write about in my book.
But I guess it would be safe to say reincarnation is not the Muslim viewpoint.
No.
Okay. Okay.
It is absolutely not.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Go ahead.
Right.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but, you know, that was a logical question, I think.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Yeah. The Israeli Druze also fight in the Israeli army against other Arabs, including Druze in other countries. So Israel considers them the friendly Arabs, which is why the government wanted to show us them.
Okay.
I found them really fascinating. And after our lovely afternoon with them, a Jewish Israeli chaperone of our group told me that they practice honor killing, a term that I'd never heard before. And the moment that I heard it, I had the strangest sense that my life would be different thereafter.
Okay. Well, you're going to need to explain what honor killing is, because some of my listeners might not know.
Yes, that's right. Honor killing is the practice by which someone murders a female member of their family for her perceived disobedience, promiscuity, immodesty, being raped, or otherwise violating their cultural gender norms. It does sometimes happen to men, but that is much rarer. And this misconduct on the part of the female causes such a loss of good reputation for the family in the eyes of their community that sometimes the only way they see to recover is to kill her.
All right. Well, logic dictates that this, you know, how can they logically, I guess, come to that conclusion that if a woman is raped, that she has somehow shamed the family?
That is a very complicated question, Karen, and it goes into and it's part of what I was trying to ultimately, when I decided that it was something that I wanted to investigate, that I had to understand in order to get to the bottom of why it happens. So we'll get into that a little bit more.
Okay.
Why don't I share a little bit more about what honor killing is?
Okay.
While we're on that subject. So it occurs in parts of the Middle East, the Indian subcontinent, and North Africa, where honor is the highest value and hinges on the control of female family members. And unfortunately, most of the killers go free because of lenient laws or traditions in those countries. Some immigrants to westernized countries, including the U.S., have also committed honor killings. Sometimes they receive maximum punishments, and other times they find sympathy in the courts. And the United Nations says that there's about 5,000 of these homicides annually worldwide, but those are only the ones that they that are reported, that they know
wow.
about. So the real number is probably much, much higher.
This is and gender genocide.
It is, actually. It's femicide,
yeah.
By and large.
Okay.
And the victims are typically women or girls that are between 15 and 30 years of age, and it's usually a close male relative that is the perpetrator. And honor killing has become an international human rights issue because these, you know, the governments in these cultures where it occurs have repeatedly failed to protect their female citizens from it. So it's very difficult for them to rise up and speak out. Some of them have tried, some with more success than others, and, you know, people like me and other activists are, you know, making efforts to bring honor killing to the public awareness.
All right, so you said a minute ago that their honor hinges on controlling the females in their family. Now, is that only one of the things their honor hinges on, or is that the thing their honor hinges on? I guess I'm wondering, you know, is their honor also, I mean, should they be a good, you know, a fair businessman?
Mm-hmm.
Should they,
mm-hmm.
you know, not cheat their friends? I mean, they shouldn't
mm-hmm.
steal or commit adultery. I guess I'm just wondering, is all of their honor wrapped up in just controlling women?
No. I do understand that there are some other issues that are related to honor, and there's a different word for that kind of honor than there is for the female-related honor.
Okay.
And evidently, in most places, the female-related honor is by far the most critical honor to preserve.
Okay. Yeah. All right, and you're going to get into all of that as our conversation develops.
Sure.
So now you said that you felt that your life would be different when you heard this term honor
mm-hmm.
killing. Why? Why do you think that was?
Yeah. Well, when I learned that Druze women and girls live in fear of honor killing, I just identified profoundly with them. I was sexually assaulted at age 21, and at that time, at the time that I learned of honor killing, which was a few years later, I was in an abusive relationship that I was trying to figure out how to get out of. So I felt an unimaginable empathy for these women. And one thing became crystal clear to me, and this was my epiphany I spoke of earlier. As an American woman, however embarrassing or inconvenient it was, I could leave the violent
mm-hmm.
relationship I was in.
Mm-hmm.
While for most of the women and girls living under the threat of honor killing, it's the air they breathe.
Wow.
Escaping it is rarely an option.
Wow. And, you know, and when we do hear about honor killing, you know, we've heard stuff in the news about, I mean, horrible stories. I mean, there's even been organizations that were trying to get, you know, American support to, you know, put attention on different, you know, honor killings, you know, women buried up to their neck and then stoned. I mean, all sorts of horrific things. But, you know, they're sort of the isolated story that we hear about. I know there was a woman in New York whose husband cut her head off because she wanted a divorce. You know, we hear about that, but I had no idea the numbers were so great that you've just quoted, and like you said, those, you know, that's probably just a small percentage.
Well, yeah, and that's just the number that get killed.
Yeah.
Imagine the women who live in fear all their lives.
Right.
Like
right.
this is they just spend their lives hoping they're not going to be killed for honor. That number is much, much larger.
Wow. So, all right, so then what happened next in your story? So
yeah,
you find
yeah.
out about the honor killings,
mm-hmm.
and then obviously this must have taken you on some sort of an odyssey.
Well, you know, as soon as I got home, I realized I could, you know, I had the freedom to leave my abuser. Not that I didn't know that before, but it made it a lot easier to do it, realizing that I could just do it. I wasn't trapped like these women are. So that's what I did. And I moved far away from him, and I started over, and I began researching honor killing like my life depended on it. I wanted to know when it got started and where, as well as why it happens, you know, the deep why. I just felt that clearly something went very wrong at some point for it to have become normalized into a cultural practice. And I hope that by digging deeply enough into the lives and history and beliefs of those who commit honor killings that I might unravel the mystery. And it was sort of instinctive, you know, like the way a scientist studies the onset of a disease in order to find a cure. I felt that getting to an understanding of the origins of honor killing might be a doorway that would lead to eradicating it.
I see. Well, and this is, and maybe this is a good time to tell listeners to sort of, drop the shoe here. This is the honor killings that the history, their origination, you believe actually goes back to Goddess and the Divine Feminine. Would it make sense at this stage of the interview to make that connection now? Does that make sense now?
Yeah, I think so. There's a little bit leading up to that,
okay.
But I promise that it's going to connect to, you know, very significantly to the Divine Feminine in just a moment.
Sure.
I think it's important to note that, you know, when I began to research it, I noticed a great deal of hatred towards Muslims on the internet around the topic, and this was before 9/11. And the reason for that is because most honor killings seem to occur in Muslim households. But I want to emphasize that not all Muslim societies have honor killing, like Indonesia, which is the largest Muslim country. They don't have honor killing really at all that I've ever heard of. But, you know, I saw so much hatred around honor killing in Muslims coming from the West, but I just could not let myself go there. You know, when you hate, you stop trying to understand. And when you stop trying to understand, you can't create a solution. And my desire to stop honor killing overrode any feelings of anger or contempt I had. It just heightened my curiosity.
Right.
But I couldn't... Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you, you said Indonesia doesn't have it, to your knowledge. Are there countries where there's more honor killing than in other places?
Oh, yes. I'm pretty sure that it's either Pakistan or Afghanistan that are known to be kind of the epicenter of honor killing.
Do you find it odd that with us being at war with, being in Afghanistan and having, you know, this, whatever it is with Pakistan, I don't know whether they're our allies or not, this funny dance we're doing, that we don't hear more about honor killings in the news?
I think it's interesting. I do know that in times of war, honor killings go up in a war zone, and that's because the men feel like, you know, their manhood is deeply threatened when they're at war. The only thing they can often feel that they can control are the women in their home.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and war is a time of a lot of chaos, you know, socially, where, you know, women may have to be out of the house and, you know, could be thought to be talking to men they shouldn't be talking to, or, worse. So supporting peace, it couldn't be more important to this cause.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So then the next part of the story then?
Yeah. So I couldn't find the deeper causes behind the practice. Nothing substantial had been published. Unfortunately, no one had been helpful enough to publish a dissertation or a book on, you know, the angle of, you know, the origins of honor killing. The journalism that I found reported that honor killing was, you know, the origins of honor killing were unknown, or they're Islamic, which I learned was incorrect, or pre-Islamic. And I thought, okay, well, if pre-Islamic, you know, why stop there? There's a heck of a lot of history before the 7th century. Why hadn't anyone researched it further to find out more accurately when and where honor killing got its start? I started to wonder if I wasn't the most curious person on the topic out there. So,
I could understand that maybe there weren't things published in English, but you mean even women who have sort of escaped this, you know, there aren't any Arab feminists out there who've published on it?
Well, you know, I read everything that I could that was available to me in my language.
Right, right.
And I think escaping it is the rare occurrence, actually.
Right, right. Okay.
And there are, you know, and this was, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, you know, while I was doing this research. So, you know, it's getting better. But at the time, you know, I looked for everything I could find. And what I found was very disappointing. And so I started calling people in the honor-killing countries and asking about it. And I discovered that just asking about honor killing was taboo, never mind trying to stop it. Many people, even at non-governmental organizations that, you know, were claiming to be trying to help women, would cut off communication with me when I started to politely inquire.
Like what organizations, like Amnesty International or people like that? Or
No. When I was calling, you know, organizations that were on the ground in, you know, other countries who were working, you know, directly with people, they're not American-based organizations. You know, I really wanted to talk to, you know, the locals.
Right.
They were scared. They were absolutely scared to say very much, and they didn't like that I was poking around into the origins and would be publishing something about it. You know, and I just thought, wow, how amazing that in this day and age to stand up against violence against women and girls is still a subversive act in a large part of the world.
Wow, that's a sad thought. And when you, I mean, and you can understand why. I mean, they're afraid to be killed. They're afraid to be singled out.
Mm-hmm.
But but by their silence, they're complicit in a way.
Exactly, and that's exactly what I thought. Is that, you know, that's how this practice has gone on unabated for who knows how long. And I remember specifically when I had this realization, I felt this chill like sweep over my whole body when I realized that honor killing would continue indefinitely because of this conspiracy of silence unless somebody spoke up louder.
Well, and it reminds me of the female genital mutilation, too. I mean, that goes on because women perpetuate it. Women won't say, stop this. You know, mothers and grandmothers are doing it to their daughters.
Yes.
So, you know, women have a lot of work to do too. It's not just the men.
That is absolutely true. So many of these women have completely forgotten about, you know, they don't know where they came from. They don't know the history. They don't remember that they don't know that they've been brainwashed and it's been, you know, given to them, you know, down, you know, from one generation to the next, until finally somebody just surrendered and said, forget it, I'm just going to go with what they're making us do because it's too hard to fight it. And then they just teach their daughter, just go with it, go
right.
with it.
This it becomes what we do. The norm. It becomes
yeah.
the norm.
Yeah.
So finally, what sort of cracked the door open for you?
Well, I think what really solidified my commitment to keep going, in spite of having all these doors shut in my face, was when I started to think about, you know, that it wasn't just the 5,000 that are killed. You know, of course, they're the ones who suffer the worst of it. You know, but what about all the other ones who are living curtailed lives to avoid being killed?
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, I wonder how many women live like that. How many girls live like that? And to my shock, I couldn't even locate the statistic.
Hmm.
No one had published it anywhere. And let me tell you, I read everything. I've got a bibliography on my website that has got 150 sources on it.
Wow.
So I calculated it myself, and I'm not a statistician, but I looked at the countries where I know this happens, and I figured out, you know, how many women live in this country. And I would say that as many as 800 million women and girls live under a lifelong death threat of honor killing, or at least, you know, they're living under extremely oppressive cultures where their choices are not their own by and large, and probably most of them could be murdered if they fail to toe the line.
Wow.
So, you know, when I figured that out, I went, you know, wow, I was just so determined to grasp the underpinnings of honor killing and expose what I found. And from there, this fictionalized story began to come alive in my imagination. So I went straight back to Israel, and I set up several extremely rare, hard-to-get homestays with these mysterious Druze. And I observed and interviewed many of them at length, as much as they would tell me anyway. And at home and abroad, I just painstakingly followed my instincts across many different disciplines for clues to the origins of honor killing. You know, I'm not a scholar or an expert on the topic. I wasn't in a program, a scholarly program. A sensible person would have written a dissertation and gotten a PhD out of it, but I was just a curious activist artist, and it took me a decade, but I did build a theory of the ancient lost origins of honor killing, which I wove into my novel.
All right. So, well, I want to hear more about the Druze, and I want to hear more about those conversations you had, and I want to hear how it's connected to the divine feminine.
Yeah.
So I'll be quiet and let you talk.
We are almost there. So what I did not expect to discover, I didn't know what to expect to discover, but I certainly didn't expect to discover that honor killing appears to be one of the lingering legacies of a pivotal time of transformation in human history that has largely been swept under the rug. And I think, you know, many of your listeners are very astute about, you know, the history of the divine feminine in different parts of the world. So they probably know that in the approximately 130,000 years of human civilization, only the last 5,000 to 7,000 years have been dominated by patriarchal religions and power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, about 6% of the time that Homo sapiens have been around, you know, living civilized lives,
right.
has it been patriarchal. And the archaeology reveals that, you know, for at least the other 123,000 years, worship of the sacred feminine was the primary and first religion almost everywhere. And as a result, women enjoyed power and respect and rights that would blow a lot of people's minds, you know, matrilineal descent of name and property and rights to the throne. When patriarchy began to take over about 5,000 B.C., it took about 5,000 years of violent aggression and bloody battles to oust the goddess, and it was so thorough, the past was almost erased from history. Thank God for archaeology and mythology. And I believe that it was in this period of time, in this violent transition between the goddess to the god, that honor killing was born. This is important because it was during this time that women became the property of men. And that is the one common denominator of all honor killings, that the female is considered property of the male members of the family. So it's not strictly, you know, what religion or ethnicity, nationality, economic status, or education that gives you a risk factor. And, you know, when resources started to become scarce somewhere between 9,000 and 6,000 B.C. Every asset a clan had was safeguarded, including the women. A man, you know, who was in control of his property was a man of honor. A man who was not was a dead man. That's how that got started.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
So are you saying then that the honor killing, I mean, was, I'm still missing the dots where they connect. Is it women, you think, started to be killed because they weren't giving up the goddess or because they weren't giving up their freedom and independence? Is that what you mean, or am I missing your point?
Yes, it was a way of asserting control.
Okay.
You know, this is the way we're doing it now, you know. There are some deeper, you know, reasons as to why honor killing continues. You'd think maybe they would have gotten past that, but there are scholars who study human sacrifice that say that when cultures don't understand their own deep-seated myths, they're in danger of taking them literally and acting them out violently. And, you know, this could happen if, for example, the origins of the myths were long ago forgotten. some anthropologists believe that the scapegoat sacrifice is a ritual reenactment of a founding murder in the culture, one that is so traumatic to its people that it was disguised in the resulting mythology. So they repeat ritual killings to get a fix, but they're not conscious of this. These cultures of the honor violence zone did such a good job of destroying the divine feminine and most of her memory that few people there even know that 95% of their culture's history was spent worshiping the goddess and treating human women with reverence. So it's my theory that every time they butcher a woman for honor now, they are unconsciously, ritually reenacting the destruction of the divine feminine, killing the goddess, because that's how it all began.
Wow. Wow, that's pretty intense. I mean, I remember when I was researching my book and I got to Turkey, I just stumbled onto an article about a woman scholar in Turkey. She was about 90, had been thrown into jail because she uncovered that headscarves were really pre-Islamic in nature. They had nothing to do with Islam. They were pre-Islamic in nature, and it was part of sexual rites that men and women took part in, you know, before the time of Islam. And they threw her in jail for that. And she ended up getting out. But it's interesting because, you know, we can find these little threads from that time, from the past, and we see that they're still having, you know, the pre-Islamic traditions are still affecting us today, whether we can still follow that track exactly or not, you know?
Yes. Yes, they sure are. Turkey has that. She's not the only one who's discovered things and made to stop.
Well, and also, too, I mean, this might be an interesting, you know, we said this before we started the interview and went live, but I'm sure what a lot of Muslims don't even know is that the Kaaba stone, and this is from Muslim scholars, I didn't make this up, this isn't a feminist fantasy, that the Kaaba stone in Mecca, in that little that almond shape that's so yoni like, that little, I think it's about 12 inches in size, that meteorite in there that they worship used to actually be worshipped as the goddess before it was, you know, taken over by Islam. And like I said, this is from Muslim scholars, because in that part of the world, when things fell from the sky like that, they were worshipped, just like the stone of Aphrodite that's in the museum in Cyprus, you know.
Yeah.
So it was a common thing. But anyway, I'm digressing. Let me you get back to your story. So what was it like staying with the Druze, Amy? I mean, are they a mystical sect? I mean, were they forthcoming and open with you, the women, you know, telling about this stuff, or guarded, or what?
No, they were guarded. I stayed with a couple of non-religious families. They usually become religious when they get into their older years. But I was taken to one of the a relative's house, a grandfather and grandmother who were very religious, and I interviewed them as well. So I got a little bit of a different perspective, and you know, they're very gracious, lovely people who want to be left alone. They live in the hill towns. They want to be able to practice the religion, and they have no desire to control the state. Just leave us alone and let us, you know, do our thing. And you know, they're willing to fight in the army. Their allegiance is to whatever the government is of that country they live in. And unfortunately, that arrangement has made it possible for them to commit honor killings in Israel that the Israeli government does not handle justly all the time.
What do you mean by that? I'm not sure I understand.
What I mean is they have an arrangement. We'll fight in the army, be, you know, the friendly Arabs. You leave us alone and let us do what we want with our women.
Oh, don't restrict our religion. Don't restrict our culture,
well,
I see.
Well, yeah, and turn a blind eye when we commit honor killing to a certain degree. Or you know, don't prosecute all the way. Don't investigate completely. You know, all the steps along the way to that you need to do to get somebody put into prison for something like that, you know, make it a little bit easier on us. And there's a history of that.
So is this one of those situations that we hear, I know happens in Africa, that a rapist can get out of being prosecuted if he marries the person he raped, or is that, or is this different?
You know, I don't think that's still happening in Israel. I think it does happen in some other parts of the world. You know, it varies, as I said, you know, by country and culture and community, even by family, clan.
Now, the Druze that you interviewed, did the women talk to you about their fear of somehow being a victim of honor killing?
No, you know, the teenage girl that I in the family where I stayed was she had a secret boyfriend, and was very cautious, but was still bending the rules. You don't have a boyfriend, you don't date. It's not done. And I was rather concerned for her.
So the marriages are arranged?
They're arranged, but they're not forced. They want the couple to be happy. It's not like in some other countries where they, you know, they do have forced marriage. It's not like that amongst the Druze, as far as I know, and that's a good thing.
Well, now, okay, so you gather up all of this information, and the story starts to, you know, come alive for you. Tell us briefly what the plot of your story was, and sort of where are you going from here now that you've written the book? What now?
Yeah. Okay. So the plot of the story is American freelance journalist Farabee McCullough Jones is struggling to sell stories from Israel when her friend Layla, a young artist in a Druze village on Mount Carmel, becomes the victim of a possible honor killing. Farabee witnesses the village celebration, her family's silence, and the police indifference. And enraged, she launches a most unwelcome investigation. She hires an oddball translator, Moshi, a Moroccan Jew who's a cross-dressing gay belly dancer from the gay ghetto of Tel Aviv. Together, they struggle to unearth Layla's traumatic life story. Layla lived a double life, painting nudes, lovers, and goddesses, taboo subjects in her culture, and selling them in Tel Aviv. They face a conspiracy of silence, police corruption, Farabee's forbidden romantic relationship with Layla's older brother, Fadi, and danger and backlash that they do not anticipate. And after a shocking turn of events, Farabee is forced to come to terms with her own painful past that's fueling this search. Then Layla's last series of paintings, entitled The Seven Perfumes of Sacrifice, prompts Farabee and Moshi to make a surprising discovery, the lost origins of honor killing, which have been suppressed for millennia and hold some volatile secrets, namely about the divine feminine. And one of these secrets leads Farabee to Layla's killer, but it turns into her worst nightmare.
And of course, you can't say any more because that'll give it away. So,
yes.
So the goddess in the Arab world does it have a place? Is it underground? Is it forgotten? Does it vary from place to place and family to family? What did you find?
I would be surprised if it exists at all anymore. I hope that there is some inkling of it there, but I think it has been so successfully suppressed that it's simply too dangerous.
Interesting.
I don't know.
I will throw this tidbit out, and I'm afraid it isn't any more than a tidbit because I didn't follow up on it. I have a friend in L.A. whose husband is, I believe, Iranian. I think Iranian, and she tweets and Facebooks with women over in the Middle East, and she claims that they are talking about the goddess there. I should connect you with her.
Mm-hmm.
And
I would love that.
And you know, it's interesting. She's also a columnist, so you guys will have a lot in common. After the show, email me, remind me. I'll put you in touch with her. And, you know, maybe you can eke out some additional information from her because, you know, it might be interesting, you know, addition for your book, maybe book two for the
Absolutely.
Next 10 years.
I'd be delighted to find out that something has been revived over there to try to restore the balance.
Right.
That's really what we need now in the world is we need a balance between the divine feminine and the divine masculine, you know, the sacred marriage and build true partnership on earth.
Well, absolutely. Well, and I'm wondering, the State Department, I mean, Hillary Clinton, Condoleezza Rice, I mean, you hear that they're making headway. Are they working on honor killings at all? Do you know?
I am not aware of those organizations or people working on honor killings. There are some wonderful organizations that are. Ayan Hirsi Ali's organization, the AHA, AHA Foundation, is working on it. The Tahrir Justice Center, Amnesty International, Women Thrive Worldwide, the United Nations, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's Unite to End Violence Against Women campaign. There are links to all of those organizations on my website, amylogan.com, if people want to get in touch with those organizations.
Now, I haven't had a chance to look at your website yet, Amy. I apologize for that. But on the website, does it talk more about, you know, just sort of honor killings in the world?
There's information on honor killing. There's more information on the Druze. I also wanted to mention that I have a charity partner, the Global Fund for Women. I'm giving 10% of my proceeds of my book to them. They fund incredible programs all over the world that empower women socially, politically, economically, you know, for their health. They strengthen women so that the women on the ground who live in these places where honor killings occur can become strong and empowered enough to become their own agents of change. And that's how it's going to happen. It's not going to be Western women like me who are going to end honor killing. We can raise some awareness, but we can help those women by helping give them the foundation so that they can begin to realize their own worth and demand something different.
Now, do you think part of the problem is the lack of education for women over there?
Absolutely, without a doubt. If you don't have education, you don't have choices, you don't have autonomy, you don't have proper health care, all of those things that you know, we American women pretty much take for granted comparatively.
Right.
It's not always the case in the honor killing zone.
Now, I want to just tell William that I see him on the switchboard, and we're going to get to him in a minute, but we have just a few more things we want to talk about before before I say goodbye to you, Amy. I want to know if there's been any backlash against you for writing this book.
Not yet. But I wouldn't be surprised.
Now, it's only just come out, though, right? It's pretty new.
3 months. It's been out.
Okay, three months. And where can listeners get the book? Is it on Amazon?
It is on Amazon, and it is on available several other places. And if you go to my website, amylogan.com, there is a link called Buy the Book, and you can see all the other places that you can purchase it.
Okay. All right. Wonderful. So, This is a big story. We really sort of jammed into a short period of time. Is there anything else you want to share? In the minute or two we have left,
yeah,
that I haven't asked you.
Yeah, I'd love to tell listeners what they can do to help with this issue. If they're feeling like, you know, so what do I do? I'd like to say, you know, keep learning about the divine feminine and women's rights issues around the world. Support your local shelters for immigrant women that are trying to escape honor violence. It's happening in the U.S. too. Better yet, befriend your neighbor immigrant women that come from the countries where you know they commit honor killings, because they could be suffering from domestic violence or threats, or, you know, you might be able to lend a hand. Make the U.S. the best possible role model and global leader for women's human rights, starting with CEDAW, C-E-D-A-W. That's Convention to End All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. It's a landmark international agreement adopted by the U.N. in the 70s. Virtually every nation has ratified it except for Sudan, Somalia, Iran, and the USA, if you can believe that.
Wow.
It hasn't even been brought to our Senate floor yet, so please encourage your senators to support it to get the Senate to vote on it, and tell others about it too.
Well, I know one thing I did learn about when Republicans are in office and controlling what happens in our foreign policy, like, for instance, when George Bush was in office, I know they would not give funding to third world countries if they were practicing contraceptives, if they were practicing abortion, you know, that's a shame, quite frankly, because we know if a woman doesn't have control over her reproductive life, she doesn't have control over her life. And I also found out from friends who live in Turkey that in general, like when George Bush was in office, the government supports the conservatives rather than the liberals, because the conservatives tend to be the businessman, the liberals tend to be the academics. And I'm speaking, you know, in general terms here. So they could make money with the businessman conservatives, where the liberals, the educated people, the ones who were promoting, you know, freedom for women, well, they had nothing to gain by, you know, standing up for women and standing on the side with liberals. Instead, they were more interested in making money, and they would side with the conservatives. I'm just curious if you found the politics of this to be the same.
Well, I certainly think that withholding rights from women seems to be a fall on the side of conservatives, yes.
Right, right.
And I think that's true worldwide, unfortunately.
Right. Well, you know, it's important to point these things out, you know, because an important election is coming up, and people want to say, oh, there's no difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. Well, let me tell you, if you are a woman, there is.
Yeah, there absolutely is. And in fact, the Thomson Reuters Foundation recently did a poll of the G20 countries, and in terms of which are the best ones for women, and the United States is number six.
Number six.
Reason it fell that low is because of how our rights are starting to be stripped from us. People don't think that it's real. It is real, people.
Oh, believe me, I know. Those 1,100 bills that have been passed across the country, I mean, anti-worker, anti-woman, anti-immigrant, anti-gay, I mean, it goes on, but that's another conversation. Amy, thank you so much for being on the show. It has been fascinating. This is an important subject. Please, listeners, get her book. It is a delicious book, and learn what you can about honor killing. We women need to stick together around the world, you know, not just here at home, and this is something important to know about. And I think it's important not to just know about it, but to know why it comes about, to know why women are oppressed in other countries, you know, to get at the heart of what you know, makes women marginalized, what makes women property, and just totally understand the whole picture, and understand it's not the norm. It doesn't have to be this way. So there I am on my soapbox.
Yeah, good.
You
That's
and I
great.
Can stand there together, Amy.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Karen. I really enjoyed being on your show, and I'm so grateful for the work that you do in the world. You are really helping to restore the balance that we so desperately need, and I'm grateful for that.
Well, we all are, Amy. We all are in our own little way. So, listeners, you can find her easy. It's amylogan.com. Please go look at her website, read everything she's got there, and get her book, The Seven Perfumes of Sacrifice. Thank you so much, Amy. And keep me posted on if any new developments with the book, okay?
I sure will, Karen. Thank you.
Okay,
take
good night.
Care. Bye-bye.
Well, listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, and I'm your hostess on Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness. And that means whether the great she is a deity archetype or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks have the ability to save the world. I just want to tell you that we're about to cross the threshold here and welcome our next guest onto the show. We're going to say hello to William Kennedy here. Hi, William.
How are you, Karen? Very nice to be here tonight.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I appreciate you being on the show tonight. You and I did a little reciprocation here. You had me on one of your radio shows, and I talked about the Sacred Feminine for a Sustainable Future, and now you're doing me the same favor, coming back on the show, talking about all the many things you're involved in. You're a busy guy, William.
Oh, yeah, I'm very, very busy. My interests are broad. I'm a full-time writer and speaker, and I focus primarily on occult history and paranormal phenomenon, but I have a very wide interest. I'm also a documentary filmmaker. I currently have a series that's running in the United States on the Biography Channel about serial killers, of all things. It's called Killer Kids. And it was originally made by the Discovery Channel in Canada, and they sold it to the Biography Channel. And people can see that for free if they go to williamhkennedy.com. But tonight I will discuss an article I wrote a few years ago entitled The White Goddess, Tracing the Roots of the Matriarchy versus Patriarchy Debate.
Okay.
And that appeared in a magazine called New Dawn, which is out of Australia, in September 2010. And I'm in that issue with other alternative thinkers like Eric von Daniken and Robert Schock, Robert Temple, and some of the people who take an alternative view of history as opposed to mainstream stuff.
Well, you know, you are an alternative type guy. You're interested, very much like myself, you know, not interested in the status quo so much. You want to hear about the stuff they don't want you to know about.
That's very true, Karen. We both share that in common. And my links to feminism, people will be quite shocked to hear this because I have a conservative following out there. I have a very strange following of evangelical Christians and then people who are interested in the New Age. But I've been attached to feminism since I was a very little kid. I was born in 1964, the youngest of eight children, obviously from an Irish Catholic family. And my oldest sister, who's 15 years older than myself, dated a guy in the early 70s named Danny Schechter. And Danny Schechter is an award-winning filmmaker. He worked on ABC's 2020 and won all kinds of Emmy Awards there. But back in those days, he was the newsman at WBCN in Boston, which was an all-rock radio show. And he was pretty much focused on the anti-war movement in the early, as many people in the counterculture were. But I would tag along with my oldest sister Maureen and Danny Schechter, and they would take me along when I was, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old to these various alternative things like Maoist meetings and feminist meetings. I was at the launch party for the famous feminist book, Our Bodies, Ourselves. It was in the early 70s. I was about 8 years old. I didn't read it. I just happened to be there. And I was also at, they took me to Harvard Divinity School for a feminist talk where John Lennon and Yoko Ono came and spoke. And
wow.
I shook hands with John Lennon and Yoko Ono. And again, Danny was covering this for WBCN, and I'll tell you, Yoko Ono at this feminist gathering at Harvard Divinity, she was doing this thing called screaming back then, feminine screaming.
What is that?
It's very hard to understand. She just would let out these shrieks and screams.
I've never heard of that, but
yes,
but then
Yoko Ono did this, and what was quite humorous about it is that you had all these like very uptight white Anglo-Saxon patriarchal people there, and some of them brought their kids along, and when she did the screaming, all the adults froze like statues. And all the children and John Lennon started cracking up hysterically.
Well, you know, I find old white conservatives very fearful. You know, they're afraid of anything that's not exactly like them.
Oh, I know. John Lennon and the children there got a big kick out of the way everyone reacted to Yoko screaming. But my point being, I've been around feminism and feminist ideas, you know, as a young kid. My first time on the radio, Danny Schechter, I was 8 years old, and he had me on WBCN in Boston with another guy named Charles Lacordaire on a show called The Big Breakfast. So I have a lot of experience. I'm 47 now, and I have 40 years experience in radio. I introduced Desmond Dekker, who was a very famous reggae singer before Bob Marley.
Yeah.
And who else was on the show that day was a very young comic named Martin Mull.
Oh, wow.
But Martin Mull and I got our start together, which is very, very, very strange and interesting. And
so you had very interesting formative years, William, that really, you know, literally formed the rest of your life.
It sure did, and I also became interested in the paranormal studies at that time. From there was an astrologer there named Daryl Martini, who worked at WBCN, who was known as the Cosmic Muffin because he did a morning radio astrology show, and I got very interested there again, 7, 8, 9 years old, and I was a big fan of stuff like Dark Shadows and Night Gallery, all these horror.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Well, we all were. Well, you know, before we, one last question before we start on the White Goddess and Maria Gimbutas.
Sure.
What in the world would conservatives be interested in you for? What do you talk about that piques their curiosity?
Well, I attack the old boy establishment, particularly the clubs that the very rich belong to, like the Skull and Bone Society, which
right.
is at Yale University. George W. Bush and John Kerry were both members.
Mm-hmm.
The Bohemian Grove out in California. These are male patriarchal organizations that perform some very bizarre rituals.
Is Mitt Romney or Barack Obama members of those?
They are a member of offshoot groups called the Bilderberg Group, which is in Europe, and that's the third big group I look at. And all three of these groups have been tied to very bizarre occult practices.
Hmm. Well, I always wondered about that, William. You know, I wondered if that was just a bunch of, you know, internet paranoia, because, you know, then all of a sudden, before you know it, people are talking about the Illuminati, and, you know, and I don't know how much credence to give to any of those ideas. You know, it sounds like crazy talk, but, you
well,
know, a lot of times there's a kernel of truth in crazy talk.
I'll give you an example. In the year 2000, the two people running for president, John Kerry and George W. Bush, were both members of the Skull and Bone Society at Yale University, which is a Masonic spinoff. And a woman wrote a book about the Skull and Bones, and they clearly demonstrate that part of their initiation ceremony is they kneel before a student who's dressed up as Lucifer, and they are initiated as knights into this very bizarre order. Now, the simple fact that both people running for president in 1 year were both from the, they only picked 15 students a year from Yale University, and this includes, like, the founder of the CIA and all kinds of people, a founder of Time magazine,
but
very rich.
But when they're doing that, I mean, or I guess I find it hard to believe that they would literally be pledging themselves to Satan. They probably just think it's a college frat boy joke, do you think, or no?
One fellow filmed part of their ritual, which was taking place in a courtyard that they have at their headquarters at Yale, and it doesn't seem to be a fraternity-style prank. It seems to be they perform a mock human sacrifice in this courtyard, and the initiates are being screamed at and almost tormented, and they seem somewhat frightened. So what we know of it, it's not, they try and write it off as, you know, fraternity hijinks, but it seems very intense and very real. Now, if people want to check the facts for themselves, they can go to williamhkennedy.com, and in my Satanic Crime Multimedia page, I have links to all kinds of documentaries on the Skull and Bones from the History Channel and National Geographic. And I encourage people really to examine these things and make up their own minds. You know, I'm kind of a libertarian Democrat myself. I'm a lifelong, I've been a registered Democrat since 18. There again, the people I grew up with, like Noam Chomsky, I used to see at Danny Schechter's house, and Norman Mailer, and people, you know, from the far left, some of these people have come on my own radio show, as you have, called Sphinx Radio. I just had Gore Vidal on. So I tend to land politically on the left myself.
Mm-hmm.
But what people on the conservative right are now learning is that this right-left distinction, there are certainly important differences, but when you see it's really the same patriarchal power structure that seems to run the world, and they are tied to these secret societies, whether, you know, you like it or not. I mean, Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon were both members of the Bohemian Grove out in California, and they're a rich boys club that perform a bizarre ritual in front of a giant owl,
and
they dress up in Ku Klux Klan type outfits. I mean, this has been confirmed.
It will, and is the purpose of, you know, pledging to continue to, you know, control the world and keep us all cogs in the wheel?
Yes. Yes,
okay.
And these are the richest and most powerful people on earth belong to these very small elite organization. I mean, the Bohemian Grove has a 30,000 people who are on a waiting list to join, and there's about 300 or 400. Jimmy Carter was a member of the Bohemian Grove.
That's surprising. For some reason, I would think he would shirk something like that. But then,
quite shockingly, no, he did not. I mean, he has attended Bohemian Grove meetings when both the Bushes were there. So,
wow.
You start to wonder what these people are doing behind the scenes. Richard Nixon, on part of the tapes they have from the White House, he accused it of being, he was a member, but he also said there was homosexual activity there between members. So there's a lot of hypocrisy. And as I say, the conservative right is also looking at these organizations and wondering why these small group of very powerful white men seem to control everything.
Well, but don't they tend to want white men to keep controlling everything?
Yes. Yes.
But it's, so while they want white men to keep controlling everything, there's some of them are starting to question it, though, that maybe they need to be spreading the wealth or what?
Well, not so much. These people would have Christian beliefs, and they don't like these bizarre rituals.
Okay, so they're looking at
people
it for that.
Form.
I see, because they're not acting very Christian-like in their...
No, not in these rituals they do, not when you're dressed in a Ku Klux Klan-type outfit and having a mock human sacrifice before a giant owl.
Okay,
I mean,
see
that's a pagan kind of thing. not a pagan in a Wicca sense, but pagan in a patriarchal sense.
Yeah, a non-Christian. Well, you wouldn't see that happening
right.
at your corner church. Let's put it that way. All right. Well, let's go ahead and shift over. That's really interesting. Maybe I'll have you back on and we'll talk more about that. But I promised listeners tonight we were going to talk about the White Goddess and Maria Gimbutas. So, what motivated you to write about the White Goddess to begin with?
Well, I was a big fan of Robert Graves, who was a novelist and poet. I was a huge fan. He did a series called I, Claudius, which was based on his books.
Mm-hmm.
So I started to read a lot of all of Robert Graves' stuff. He wrote novels and essays. And one of the books he wrote kind of tied into my interest in the occult and paranormal. It was called The White Goddess, he wrote in 1945. And what he posited in this really fascinating book is what he felt. He was really the first person to come out and say that the oldest form of human religion was a goddess-worshipping cult that existed in the Neolithic Europe, that Stone Age Europe. These would be the Cro-Magnon people who overtook the Neanderthals and lived in Europe and were eventually conquered by Indo-Europeans who call themselves Aryans. Now, I'm going to use the word Aryan tonight, and I just want to steal it back from Adolf Hitler. I'm not referring to a master race. This is what some Caucasian people in the Russian steppes in the Caucasus Mountains in near southern Russia call themselves.
Okay.
And they invaded Europe and deposed this Cro-Magnon goddess religion, which Maria Gimbutas, who I met, by the way, in 1989, very nice woman, fascinating woman. And what she basically said, her and Graves together, is that this goddess religion was the oldest form of religion and the oldest form of civilization. Now, Robert Graves himself got a little bit flaky in The White Goddess in that he started moving letters around to prove what he was saying in different ancient languages. Now, I can understand why people criticize that, because you can really make anything say anything. I saw a thing on TV about this Bible code thing where there's this guy in Israel who says if you move the letters around, the New Testament predicts the suicide of Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah, I saw that too.
So you do get some, I can see why they criticize it. And what Robert Graves believed, he believed that there was a feminine moon deity out there, a real metaphysical being that inspired him to write these poems.
Oh.
And he was operating from this mystical, poetic perspective. So his original encounter with this was very, very esoteric and mystical, as I said. It wasn't really analytical or historical. And he starts from that perspective. And what he claims is that the Greeks and the Romans came in and they really solidified a patriarchal god, Zeus or Jupiter, in southern Europe. And later on, the Celts, who were a later Aryan people, came into northern Europe, and they retained much of this old goddess culture that existed before they invaded, and that the Celts retained this matriarchal religion more so than the Romans did, and that it eventually survived into the Middle Ages, into what we would now call Wicca or witchcraft, or, you know, midwives and herbalists and things like that. And Graves also believed that love poets were literally imbued or possessed by the lunar moon goddess.
Because he felt he did. So it sounds like this all started for him because he had an experience of the goddess, and that motivated him to pursue the idea. Is that what
that would be
you
an
say?
Excellent summation, Karen. This was from his very beautiful love poems that he wrote. He would have his personal life was very strange. Robert Graves was bisexual, and he always had girlfriends on the side. He was married twice and also had a long affair with Laura Riding, a woman who was kind of an early feminist. But he would have basically bisexual encounters, and he would focus primarily on these young, beautiful women who he saw as personifications of the muse. And he would, you know, become romantically involved with them and write this very beautiful, stunning love poetry, which he became famous for. He was a professor of poetry at Oxford at one time. So his poetry is wonderful. Now, his first wife didn't put up with this hanky-panky, which she saw it as. You know, these were Victorian people, you have to remember.
Right, right.
They had very Victorian attitudes. So she broke up with him, then he hooked up with Laura Riding, and then he married another woman who tolerated his
philandering
for – he didn't see it that way, okay? He wasn't Christian. He rejected Christianity, and he was kind of a proto-free love person, for lack of a better term.
So he was not Victorian. He was not into monogamy. And he saw these young women as the embodiment of the goddess, and he wanted to partake.
Yes, he did, which, you know, I don't blame his first wife for not tolerating. Not many wives even today would like that. But he was doing it from a spiritual perspective, and now, he's funny, he was kind of a snob in that if you didn't write this very beautiful rhyming love poetry, he didn't think you were a poet at all. He didn't like Allen Ginsberg or Lawrence Ferlinghetti or any of these newer beat poets. He didn't think that was poetry at all. So he was kind of a snob in his own way. And it's quite interesting for people who want – I don't recommend people try to read the book The White Goddess because it's very complex and very long and people tend to give it up. It was published by T.S. Eliot, who was a right-winger Christian, by the way, which is a strange irony at favor in favor.
Were they friends, William?
Very good friends, yes. They had very different ideas about religion. T.S. Eliot was an Anglo-Catholic, but strangely, he tolerated Graves' neo-paganism, which is odd. There again, we have these links between conservative patriarchs and very liberal matriarchs, which is a strange bedfellows kind of thing.
Well, you know, I opened the show by saying to listeners, you know, that book you probably have on your bookshelf because everyone believes they should have it, but you've probably never opened it because it's so thick and intimidating. I'm wondering, William, was his work respected, you know, by, you know, the people in the know? I mean, was he considered a noted scholar, or was he controversial?
No, Celtic scholars and mainstream academics just ignored the book, basically. He addressed it to Celtic scholars, but they just basically, he said they loudly ignored it, was Graves' term. And if people want a good summation of it, there's another book he wrote called Five Pens in Hand, which has a very consolidated version of his white goddess theory, which there again states that the oldest form of human religion is goddess worship, that, you know, with that scenario I described earlier. And it's quite interesting because he was offered, he mentions in this essay on the white goddess in Five Pens in Hand, that he was offered the leadership of various neo-pagan groups in the late 40s and early 1950s, which he refused. He was very much an individualist.
So what did, you know, I'm one of those people who have the book and never opened it. What was the basis for him discovering goddess worship so long ago? Was it the Venuses of Willendorf or just archaeological stuff in the British
Museum? No, it was more literary. He looked at ancient myths.
Okay.
Concluded that a lot of the mythology you saw were overthrows of a goddess religion.
Ah, I can imagine him and Joseph Campbell would have made great friends.
He didn't like Campbell. Robert Graves was a very odd man. There's very few other writers he liked or respected. You'd think he would like J.R.R. Tolkien, too, but J.R.R. Tolkien beat Robert Graves at Scrabble once, and Robert Graves always resented him for it, strangely enough, a game of Scrabble. But, no, he was very dismissive of other writers and scholars.
So what did he not like about Joseph Campbell?
Well, the Jungians, he would say, the Jungians are reading too much into world mythology. He thought you should really examine mythologies. You can look for commonalities, but he thought they saw too many commonalities, which he didn't believe were quite true. He didn't believe in the concept of archetypes and believed that this goddess who he worshipped was the ultimate deity. And
so did he touch base with Dion Fortune, or, I mean, did...
No, he never hooked up with many other people. He moved to Mallorca in the 1920s.
Okay.
And basically stayed there the rest of his life. Now, a lot of writers would visit him. Like, I have an interview on my webpage. Colin Wilson was very good friends with Robert Graves.
Okay. Well, did he have any sense of the ideas that Maria Gimbutas put forth?
It's quite interesting because Graves came up with it first, but he used, as I said, linguistic evidence from mythology,
mm-hmm.
which he writes about in The White Goddess. Now, Maria Gimbutas, who I met in 1989 at UCLA, a very nice woman, as I said earlier, she was an archaeologist, and she was originally an archaeologist who centered on the Aryan people. The Indo-Europeans I talked about earlier and how they came into Europe, she was Lithuanian. And she looked into the Mound people, she called them, because the Aryans built these mound fortresses and graves all around Europe when they invaded. Now, by studying the Aryans, she asked herself, well, what was before the Aryans? And that was where she got into this goddess Cro-Magnon culture, which is quite interesting when you consider that 8,000 years ago, 6,000 years before the Common Era, there were full cities that were goddess cultures in Eastern Europe, in the Balkans and in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And they had large cities of about 15,000 people. They had two-story buildings and three-story buildings. They had manufacturing. They made pottery and fishing and agriculture, and they even had their own kind of language or symbolic system. So they were quite arguably the first civilization as opposed to being a hunter-gatherer or horticulturist society. They were the first civilization in the complex sense of the term.
Well, and I wonder if Çatalhöyük would maybe fall under that category in Turkey.
Yes. I mean, they say that the Robert Schock's doing some work on that now. He's a friend of mine. And this is about the same era.
Yeah.
This is about the same time frame.
So what can you tell us that listeners who revere Maria Gimbutas, what can you tell us about her that they might find interesting and maybe haven't heard before?
Maria Gimbutas, what was interesting about her, that people, as I said earlier, she was really more an expert on the Aryans than anything else, and her work on this goddess culture came very later in her career. And it wasn't very well received by the archaeological community, who there again, people can read my White Goddess article. It's up for free at williamhkennedy.com, and I even linked at the bottom of the page a whole documentary on Maria Gimbutas called Signs Out of Time, which they can watch for free. But she was pretty much seen as a flake by archaeologists.
Right, yeah, that's true, unfortunately.
Yeah, they claim she was reading too much into this culture. And I have the counter-arguments to what she was saying in the White Goddess article that people can read through themselves. You know, I try and give a full perspective of this White Goddess culture, including the criticisms of it. But I agree with her in the sense that these highly complex cities in old Europe, around the Balkans, Eastern Europe, were in fact the first civilization. And what's fascinating and important is that from everything that we can know about them, they were nonviolent. They were pacifists.
Right.
And they worshipped a Mother Nature goddess. Now, women didn't dominate the society. It was egalitarian, but they saw the ultimate metaphysical entity as a female deity, and they didn't separate the physical from the metaphysical as we do in our modern mind frame. The earth itself was kind of saturated with the feminine divine, a kind of material, metaphysical materialism.
Well, and you can imagine if we hadn't lost that idea of the interconnection of everything being sacred, we wouldn't be in the fix we're in. You know, maybe the species wouldn't be dying, and the planet wouldn't be toxic, and you know, and on and on, and women wouldn't be subjugated. You know, it boggles the mind how life on planet might potentially have been different if the patriarchy had not taken over and overran these egalitarian cultures.
Well, that's a fascinating thing, and this is also used as a model for perhaps reintroducing some of these ideas into contemporary culture, especially when you see things like global warming. We're obviously abusing the earth with pollution, and these ideas are very patriarchal and very male-oriented and very dominating and very controlling, from, you know, the people who control fossil fuels to the people who control industry. This is all male-oriented. Now, where this originates is with the Aryans I mentioned earlier. And what the Aryans did is they were herders. They would herd primarily bulls, cattle, and what they did is they copied the society of the cattle, and they literally began to bully anyone they encountered. They became like bulls. The whole idea of the alpha male started with the Aryans.
Interesting. Well, patriarchal cultures, do you think they have anything to learn from feminism?
Well, I certainly do. I wouldn't be on this program if I didn't believe there was some value overall in feminism and examining this ancient culture, which, as I said, was very complex with huge cities, but there was very little violence in them that we know. Now, the only thing I will say is that from what anthropologists tell us, adolescent boys tend to fight over females. And as a former middle school teacher, I know the curse of raging hormones. So that's probably one thing that she really didn't address. But apart from that, these were very pacifist. There's no weapons. They didn't make weapons. There's no record of them fighting. So when these warrior patriarchal Aryans moved in, the Cro-Magnon culture really had no chance against them because they had tamed the horse. When you go from the Stone Age into the Bronze Age, I mean, they had bronze swords. So the goddess culture of old Europe was really helpless with the onslaught of the Aryan invasion.
Right. Well, and you wondered, you know, and well, you know, I mean, you know my perspective, and I can't help but wonder today if we did start to lead a goddess-inspired life, and you know, and we could call back the, you know, cherry pick the best ideas from that culture and plant them in our society, and you know, maybe, I mean, I'm sure we wouldn't have a utopia. I mean, that might be expecting way too much, but it seems like you know, there could be a lot more justice and fairness on the planet than we have today, and not to mention, you know, the exploitation of the earth and the human resources and the species and everything else that you know, just seems to be totally under attack by this predator patriarchy.
Oh yeah, I mean, there are a lot of feminists who are eco-feminists who are inspired by Maria Gimbutas and Robert Graves and like Mara Lynn Keller, and there is a Hindu woman named Vandana Shiva.
Yeah, I've had her on the show. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I mean, they're pretty fascinating eco-feminists who are saying these very things. Now, the problem is those people I mentioned earlier, like in these secret societies, like the Bohemian Grove and the Skull and Bones, they're very tied into the fossil fuel, oil, gasoline industry.
Yeah.
And they will do things like pay people not to look into renewable energy.
Mm-hmm.
They will pay people universities will give big grants so they don't look into things like wind farms,
right,
and renewable sorts of things.
Well,
the only person I can think of from this old boy network who adopted any of this originally was Henry Wallace, who was the former vice president under Roosevelt before Truman. He was an agriculturist, and he had a lot of these ideas about renewable energy and stuff, but they basically cheated him out of the presidency. They replaced him with Truman because he refused to speak in front of segregated audiences.
Well, shades of Al Gore cheated him out of the presidency, you know, someone who was talking about these sorts of important subjects. It seems to be a parallel there a little bit.
That has been drawn before, and Al Gore was seen as kind of the successor of Henry Wallace, and he was definitely cheated. If people remember, the 2000 election was highly contested.
Yeah.
And Fox News, a relative of George W. Bush's, actually kind of swayed the final votes in that. So the Supreme Court ultimately decided the 2000 election, not the people, not the Electoral College. The Supreme Court of the United States essentially overthrew the government and imposed George W. Bush as a kind of unelected dictator, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, and I agree. And I mean, look what they're doing now with Citizens United. They're basically handing the country over to, you know, they're turning into a plutocracy or an oligarchy. And, you know, democracy, you know, they're killing democracy. And it's shameful. I mean, it's really shameful. I guess they don't care about their legacy or how history is going to view them. I mean, obviously, all they care about is money and power and control. And it's despicable. I mean, they're shameful. I can't say enough about, I mean, I don't even think it's patriotic. It feels like terrorism from within, quite frankly. It really does.
Oh, definitely. That's a very good term. And I mean, look at, they betrayed the labor unions. They've betrayed the working people out there who make this country run. Now they've betrayed immigrants who just come here who want to work more than people who are born in this country. You know, they've really betrayed the roots of this country in the sense of the pursuit of happiness, because they just want to control the entire economy. And they gear our economy to put people in perpetual debt as a means of keeping them in line and under control. You know, we have this student debt bubble that's creeping up on us and all these horrible things. This is all by design, by the way. This isn't something that went wrong, like with the housing thing in 2008 when that burst. I mean, they deliberately put people in debt who they knew couldn't pay it back so that they could retain full control over the economic system. No, none of the 1% of the people who control the vast majority of the wealth in this country suffered under the current depression we're in. They've actually increased their wealth.
Well, no, and I mean, and you can see where things are headed. They're destroying the unions, which means people will have to work harder for less money. I mean, you know, they're setting up a scenario for, you know, for America. I hate to say it; it might sound drastic, but I don't think it is, for Americans to work for slave wages. You know, to have no future. You know, they want to control education. I mean, people like the Koch brothers are spending oodles of money donating to colleges so that they have a say in what professors, you know, get on the faculty and what they teach. I mean, it's total domination and
feudalism is the term I like to use.
Yeah. I mean, it's really scary, and I just hope everybody around the globe wakes up before it's too late, because there are more of us than them.
Well, when you see things like the Arab Spring and all these things, that's one positive consequence of the internet. These people no longer control the news agencies and the way information is passed along. I mean, you didn't really have programs like this, say, in the 1970s, like we're on right now.
Right.
The few and far between, if any, anywhere. And these corporations, like when I had Noam Chomsky on my show, the Supreme Court decided that there'll be no more limits on corporate contributions to politicians.
Right.
So they're basically, that was, Noam Chomsky saw that as the end of democracy in the United States. We're in a full state of corporate feudalism. We're in a security state. We're constantly in a, people don't even realize we're at war right now.
Well,
and there's no draft. It doesn't upset people, but it should. We shouldn't be doing what we're doing in the Middle East and all these things.
And you know, William, I also think too, when history is written, I think there's going to be a place about how Fox News has so totally brainwashed so many millions of people to be misinformed and vote against their economic interests. They're a big player in this disinformation, and to help these people, control and dominate the masses. I mean, I really believe that.
Well, I mean, you get your Sean Hannitys and your Rush Limbaughs out there calling, you know, feminist feminazis, and really undermining the rights of women in particular. That's the big thing. Women and minorities are really the target of these people. And you can find bad examples in any group, but they harp on things like single parents who are women who might be getting some public aid for their kids.
Well, they don't worry about corporate welfare.
It's perfectly all right to bail out, you know, all these big banks and all this. That's no problem to them because they're benefiting from it. But if some poor woman who has three kids and an inefficient spouse gets on the food stamp program, these people harp on it and become enraged over, you know, the few crumbs that they throw the poor in this country.
Like the poor are living great, you know, like they're living in mansions, sipping on pina coladas in their hammock.
Well, there's the old image of the welfare queen and
right.
all these really false myths, because when you look at people who, anyone on public aid, if it's Social Security, disability insurance, or food stamps or what have you. It's just sustenance living. It's just barely, it's shelter and barely food.
Right.
So they're not, you know, the myth of the welfare mother and all this stuff is complete nonsense. In fact, if it were up to me, I would triple the benefits to the poor in this country. You know, they don't want a health care system, and we're the only developed nation in the world, and we have the best medical science in the world, yet we have no social medicine.
Right.
It's sick. It's sick.
Yeah, it's we're in a bad state, and we really do need to you know, wake up and grab our lives back, or we're gonna really be in trouble. Well, William, we've sort of digressed here, and while that is a favorite subject of mine, and I appreciate talking to you about it, I do want to just ask a few more things.
Sure.
You call yourself a member of the traditionalist school. What do you mean by that?
The traditionalist school is a group of thinkers who started with a man named René Guénon and Ananda Kumaraswamy, who were writers back in the 1920s and 30s. And basically, they believed in a transcendent unity of religion. In other words, that the different major religions of the world, like Christianity and Judaism and Hinduism and Buddhism, are different expressions of the same divine order, and it gives legitimacy and tolerance to non-Christian religions.
Well, imagine if we didn't have religion to fight over. Gee, there might be peace. We can't have that, can we?
Well, you know, I'd rather look for common ground between religions. I mean, even in Christianity, you have in medieval times, they were far more in tune with nature and being good stewards of the earth than we are now.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
the earth is just something to be exploited.
Yeah. There's commonality there. Now, the traditionalists, they can be conservative in the sense that they tend towards the more conservative branches of the different religions, which I don't necessarily do. But it's odd. I'm from a Catholic background, and conservative Catholicism is strange in that the more conservative and traditional you get, the more goddess-type religion you encounter with Marian devotion.
Hmm. Well, that's an interesting way to look at it. Okay.
It's very odd because traditionalist Christians want to make Mary like co-mediatrix of all graces along with God. You worship the Mother of God. You say Hail Marys and the Rosary, which is very, very sacred feminine oriented, oddly
right,
enough.
Absolutely.
And I know that's a strange contradiction and not easy to explain.
But it makes sense to me. I mean, they're elevating the feminine face of God, where there are a lot of Christians who didn't want to give Mary that power. They felt it took away from the stature of Jesus.
Now, the most mystical experience I've ever had in my life was at a May procession when I was in Catholic school, which you coronate a statue of the Virgin Mary as the Queen of Heaven.
I used to do that too. I come from a Catholic background. Yeah, I put that.
You know, that's a very goddess type feminine sort of ritual.
So you see, even when I was six, I was honoring the goddess, and I didn't know it as I put that wreath on the Blessed Mother's head.
Yeah, it's very, very, very odd how these things connect, and that's why I so strongly believe in dialogue between feminists and people who might have a more patriarchal view. Let's find some dialogue and some common ground to try and solve the horrible problems we have in this world with hunger and unemployment and the oppression of women.
You're absolutely right, William. Yeah.
The dignity of the earth itself.
Yeah.
Because this is just lost in our contemporary paradigm. I mean, just the pollution problem alone, it might kill us all.
Well, you know, William, you are one of the men that we need going forward in the future. You know, there's so many men out there that you know, would just as soon continue the patriarchal oppression, but we need more of them like you, and you're proof that they're out there. So why
I mean, you have to remember, there's a lot of willfully ignorant people in the world, and that is the biggest enemy to our survival as a species, the willfully ignorant who won't see any commonality or try and find any form of mutual aid between people who might have different spiritual beliefs.
Right.
And that's a big, big problem, the willfully ignorant. And that's a very patriarchal kind of left brain sort of thinking. You are mentioning the right brain, left brain dichotomy earlier. And that's the biggest enemy we have, as well as the overall dumbing down of the general population in the Western world. People aren't reading anymore. They're skimming through things. People don't read books. So we have
right.
a lot of challenges ahead of us if we want to survive as a species.
Well, you're right. I mean, there's no critical thinking. And imagine Americans, you know, wearing as like a badge of honor their anti-intellectualism. You know, I mean, Sarah Palin, I think, you know, was great at that. It was almost as if, be proud if you're ignorant, you know. I mean, that's sort of, I felt like to me that's what she was the beacon of, you know.
Instead Well, you get people like Sarah Palin and Margaret Thatcher who are for more. More or less, they've gone over to, they're more or less men in women's bodies, quite
right.
frankly. They don't, I'm not very impressed with them.
No, well, me either. We agree on that as well. Well, William, as we come to a close here, why don't you tell us about the resources on your webpage so that my listeners can find out about the fount of information you have available.
Well, go to williamhkennedy.com, and if you scroll down to the bottom of the page, I have these multimedia link pages I put up, and I've literally organized and linked hundreds, if not thousands at this point, of documentary films that are on the Internet, and I have a witchcraft and neo-pagan page, which I think your listeners would find very interesting, and I have films on Maria Buddhists and all sorts of interesting stuff. I have the documentary The Goddess Remembered, which is about this culture we're talking about, and interviews with Starhawk and all kinds of pagan things. I even get into people who misuse paganism and become criminals. So there again, I give the full spectrum as much as possible, and it's free, williamhkennedy.com. It's
okay.
I put it together. I just want people to expand their minds and maybe think outside of the box more than we are allowed to in our society.
Well, sounds good to me, William. Thank you. Thank you for your time tonight. I really appreciate it. And I have a few questions for you I'm going to send to you via email. And, you know, I'll be in touch with you tomorrow. Thank you. Thank you so much, William. I really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.
Okay. Good night, Karen. Thank you. And God bless everybody. Or Goddess bless everybody, if you want to put it that way.
There you go. Thank you,
very
William.
Good.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
Well, that was fun. William's a fun guy, and like I said, you know, we need more guys like him moving forward. Well, before we go tonight, I'd like to give you a sneak peek of what's coming up on Voices of the Sacred Feminine. Actually, Thursday of this week. Yes, this week we actually have two shows. I forgot why that happened, but it is what it is. You got an extra show this week, listeners. We will have Lynn Andrews on the show. You might recognize that name. She has written dozens of books. Well, she's going to be with me discussing her newest book, Coming Full Circle, Ancient Teachings for a Modern World. And we're also going to have scholar Amy Levin on the show. She's going to share her work tracing contemporary religious movements in American history and where they intersect with liberal religion and feminism. I know one of the things we're going to talk about at least is Kabbalah, because Kabbalah is very interesting when it comes to the sacred feminine, and I'm hoping maybe she'll know something about about Mormonism as well, because there is a sacred feminine in Mormonism, believe it or not. But I think in both of these spiritualities or religions, whichever they are, they're not quite what we would want them to be. I'm not sure the sacred feminine really is empowered, but she'll tell us about that. So I guess I would like to finish off by saying, have a great Wednesday, and come back with me Thursday, and I look forward to it. And may Goddess embrace you in her golden wings. Good night.
Mm-hmm.